You did. A little creature licked me in the face real early in the morning and wanted to go out, so... It's better than an alarm clock. I mean, yes, that dog knows the very minute that I'm supposed to get up and take him out, so... But if you're curious, it was the multi-axis trainer that I couldn't handle. Unfortunately, it was the very last simulation they had at the camp, so I was able to kind of wooze my way through to the end. And the lady was saying, you know, no one's ever gotten dizzy on this thing. I was the first to get dizzy on that thing. It's kind of a, you know, you get these three different axes that rotate your body upside down and all over the place. And as long as it's random, you're okay. But I got a non-random ride. It just kept going and going. So I got dizzy in a hurry. That's right. So it worked out okay. But I was really proud of my son, David. He was there as the commander of the shuttle simulator. And it's really like the real thing. And just watch them switch all those switches and put in the computer commands. And they make you do it on the second. You're watching this clock, and you have to follow all these instructions, and everything has to be switched to exactly the right second. You have to speak these commands at just the right second. Anyway, he got a special commendation from the camp director for his ability to read and to stay on time. So... And it's the same thing with my wife. I mean, she came back from teaching this class last Sunday, and I said, well, how did it go? And she said, well, it wasn't great, but it was okay. But then I found out from some of you that it was really the other way around, so I always have to check with someone else about that. So, and I'm getting a little bit worried about my older boy, Joel. I mean, he's going to be 12 next month. And, you know, this is graduation day at the church where they move on to the next grade. So he's going into junior high. And they had a special pancake breakfast today for all the kids going to the seventh grade. But Joel couldn't make it. He had to have breakfast at home first. And so he had his home breakfast. And he went there and had breakfast. And I noticed he had breakfast again when he showed up at the home. He was here early enough to partake of all the sausages and bacon and everything else.
He is so normal. Scary.
Well, you know, it's about this time again. You say, you know, gee, maybe we better begin to start saving for college. And you realize there's no way we're going to be able to save for college. We'll have to get a second refrigerator. So, yeah, I'm worried that Joel's taking after me. That's when my parents literally had to get a second refrigerator. So, it was a tough time for them.
Carried a full-size shopping bag.
Yeah, my lunch bag was a duffel bag, so. But I relieved my parents of the need to pay for college. Canada's a great system. I went through the whole 9 years without having to pay a dime. It was wonderful. So, I realize that's not going to happen here. So, but, looks like you got your facts and faith, Tom. So it's a lot of people are telling us that it's one of the more exciting facts and faith because of all the new discoveries. And it was sure fun writing up about all those new discoveries. But this week I was... Yeah, that's part of my job. I tell Kathy, he says, boy, these are exciting discoveries to you about how we are going to translate this stuff. So... But this week I was up in Seattle preparing what they call a video news release, which is kind of in preparation for what NASA is going to be doing on July 4th. And it's going to take a minor miracle for us to make that deadline. But the amazing thing is here we're dealing with this NASA report about the possibility of life on Mars. And this is the week where there was a new NASA announcement that comets are raining down water in all the solar system planets. And therefore, there's got to be life everywhere in the solar system. The usual fallacy of saying, if we find water, therefore, there's got to be life. But just before I went up to Seattle to do this television recording, one of our astronomers, ironically an astronomer who's in Seattle, Guillermo Gonzalez, he wrote an article on the last facts and faith. He sent me a preprint. Says, Hugh, you'll probably be interested in this. It's going to be published in about 5 weeks. And I read this thing, and here's this non-Christian geologist who took this NASA discovery of water being rained down on Earth and other solar system bodies by comets. And he says, if you look at the Earth situation, what he was able to calculate was to take that cometary infall rate, and he realized it had to be incredibly fine-tuned to support life on Earth. And more than that, you have to fine-tune life itself in order to match the cometary infall. And what's really going on is he points out that these comets are raining down water, carbon dioxide, and methane upon the Earth. And says all three of them are greenhouse gases. And so if you get too much of this cometary stuff coming down, it'll raise the temperature of the Earth, and life's not possible on planet Earth any longer. So the other side of the coin is if you don't get enough of this carbon dioxide, methane, and water coming down upon the Earth from comets, the planet will get too cold and will no longer be able to support life. Now he says life is a factor in all of this, in that life is constantly taking out methane, carbon dioxide, and the water from the atmosphere and converting it into such material as coal, oil, gas, and topsoil. And then you got the plate tectonics and the volcanism that drives that stuff underground. And what he discovered in this paper is that you have to very carefully fine-tune the Earth's rate of volcanism, plate tectonics, cometary infall, as well as biological activity. And this is the thing that no one had ever recognized before in the secular scientific literature, is that you have to design the quantity of life on the planet and the type of life on the planet, or all these things are going to get out of balance. And what makes it most difficult is a cometary infall rate is not constant. It varies. And so it's necessary to vary the degree of biological activity on the planet as well as the plate tectonics and the volcanism, or it'll all get out of sync. And once it gets out of sync, life's no longer possible. And, you know, the amazing thing is this has been going on for 4 billion years. Now, you see these things varying, but they vary. This is what he was declaring in his paper. The incredible thing about Earth is that these four things, which must be very carefully fine-tuned with respect to one another, have stayed in sync throughout the entire 3.86 billion years of history. Then the paper ends. You know, no comment at all on how can you possibly explain these four things that are variable staying in sync to an amazing degree for 3.86 billion years. But of course, the only possible explanation has got to be a divine creator that's tuning up all the knobs to keep everything in balance. And it kind of takes me back to my days as an undergraduate when I had summer jobs where we would be repairing electronic equipment. And I remember being forced to sit down in front of this thing that wasn't working, and there's about 25 knobs on the thing. And you have to find all the broken pieces of electronic components, repair them all. Then once it's all repaired, you have to twiddle all these knobs so that everything is peaked up and kept in sync with one another. It would literally take us a couple of days just to tune the knobs to get it all working right. So this kind of reminds me, here you got to have some intelligent creator there. Even when you've got all the components in place, everything's got to be tuned. Greg, you had your hand up first.
Does that just confirm what
is the parameter of the fine-tuning universe that you've already talked about? Is that added? This is a brand new one. This is number 65 on the list. In fact, I've just prepared a new set of overheads. I got to do this every once in a while. But this is the latest set of overheads, take into account all the design characteristics for planet Earth that we know of to date. And let's see if this is the last one. And here we go. These are the last few on the list. And here's the very last one, biomass to comet infall ratio. And it's got to be fine-tuned. Actually, this is very conservative. The fine-tuning is much better than 1%. And the bottom line is that we can now declare that the probability of finding a life support planet is less than 1 in 100 billion trillion 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 for anywhere within the universe. or less than 1 chance in 10 to the 81 that any given planet will have all the necessary conditions required for the support of life. That's this one, even taking into account generous dependency factors. So that's the latest as of a couple of days ago. So, yes. Well, what he commented on, Deming, in his paper, is that there are obvious times when the Earth was being hit by a shower of these comets. And this often leads to life going down in terms of quantity. And then it recovers in a way to take advantage of the infall and keep things in balance. And he was making reference to several extinction events where this had taken place. Now, normally what you'd expect is that you get one of these events, it would cause a rapid drop in the numbers of species and the populations of the individual species, and the planet would go dead. But he makes the point that it always recovers. Again, he made no comment as to how do you explain the recovery of life after these events. And again, it's the interruption by a creator that pulls things back in balance. Yeah, what he does not know, we do know that certain mass extinctions in the fossil record are the result of extraterrestrial disasters, either by comets or by asteroids. What this particular NASA discovery points out is that the cometary infall rate has been underestimated. And one of the reasons it's been underestimated is that you don't always see something dramatic. I mean, what was discovered is they took photographs of the upper atmosphere of the Earth, and they were seeing all these events. But you only see them in the upper atmosphere. When you're sitting on the ground, you don't see any shooting stars or meteors. And what's happening is that the Earth is being pelted by very loosely aggregated dirty snowballs. And it hits the upper atmosphere, literally like slush. It hits the upper atmosphere, gets heated a little bit, turns into slush, disintegrates, and by the time you reach the surface of the Earth, it's just a little bit of mist that's coming down. So it's not like one of these dramatic events where you see a long, fiery trail through the sky. So that's why it's been missed up until this point, but these new satellite measurements indicate that the quantity of water, carbon dioxide, methane that the Earth is absorbing by this basis on a fairly regular, literally a daily basis, is sufficient to account for almost all of volatiles, those three volatiles that we received over the history of the planet. That's kind of what the discovery is all about. Well, there's several ways you can do that. You can uncover ancient rocks which preserve the atmospheric components that existed at the time that that rock was formed. And we can see periods in the Earth's history when the oxygen content was a little higher and a little lower. You see very radical changes in the carbon dioxide and the methane quantities. So you could use that to infer that the infall must have been different at that time. You can also do what I was suggesting, link it in with the fossil record in terms of the quantity and diversity of life that existed at that particular time and say, well, the only explanation for this is some kind of a jump. And in the case of the tertiary Cretaceous catastrophe, there's no question that's the result of an extraterrestrial disaster. We know the crater. It's down in the Yucatan Peninsula. It's been dated. And we know the consequences of that event and why it would wipe out the dinosaurs, for example. So You know, there you got one very positive example of where you got a major event that dramatically disturbs what's going on normally. So I don't, maybe you got a follow up to that. Okay, I catch that point. Well, before this satellite discovery, there was a debate raging on amongst geophysicists whether the life-necessary volatiles came from underneath the crust of the Earth or came from extraterrestrial sources. What this discovery indicates is that it's primarily extraterrestrial. And therefore, geophysicists have been looking in the wrong place to explain the ocean and the atmosphere of the Earth. But what got a lot of the NASA team excited about the question of life elsewhere is that of course, must have been going on other solar system bodies. And in fact, the only question of doubt about this whole question is, well, if this cometary infall measurement is correct, then all the planets should be wet with water, and yet only the Earth is wet with water. I've seen that brought out in the journal Science, for example. That's really the only criticism, but there's a rather easy explanation for why Earth is wet with liquid water and not the other solar system bodies. We have the necessary conditions to keep the stuff. The other solar system bodies don't. You know, the moon gets pelted with the same stuff. But there's only in a place where you have craters or basins that never receive sunlight is that cometary infall going to be preserved. Because of the moon's very tiny gravity and lack of atmosphere, if it hits anywhere else, it will immediately dissipate to outer space. And so, yes, where the astronauts landed, it's bone dry. But it would be bone dry even if it was being pelted with comets at the rate we see taking place here on Earth. Yes.
Isn't the amount of water added by these comets, though, just a very small percentage of the total amount of water in all the oceans?
No, the conclusion of this discovery was that you can explain not all of the ocean, but close to it. And same thing with the atmosphere. And it really gives us a better explanation for how the Earth recovered after it lost its atmosphere and ocean. Because you know that collision we talked about where the Earth absorbed this Mars-sized object and lost its primordial atmosphere and ocean? Now, how did it recover? Well, theory was, you know, stuff bubbled up from the crust, and but this now demonstrates you don't need that. We can get it from the comets. And actually, it offers a much better explanation how we got this just right atmosphere and ocean for the support of life, and how we got rid of the atmosphere we had in the first place, which would have made it impossible for life to exist here. So, but where I think it's being misinterpreted is some NASA scientists are saying this proves that everything gets watered. Because everything gets watered, there's got to be life everywhere. And I point there was that Earth has been designed to keep the stuff, but that's not true of Mars, Mercury, Venus, Jupiter. Case of Jupiter and Saturn, it goes into frozen form immediately, which is not going to be available for life. Well, because Venus did not experience a collision like Earth did, it has kept its original atmosphere. An atmosphere that's 40 times thicker than Earth's atmosphere. And if planet Earth did not get that collision from a Mars-sized object 4.25 billion years ago, we would have had an atmosphere at least 80 times denser than what we have right now, which would have made life impossible on this planet. And this is one of the more amazing things that NASA scientists have discovered when they went to the moon. Is that Earth experienced this amazing collision, which blew off an atmosphere which would have been made it impossible for us to survive, and allowed a much thinner atmosphere to form in its place. Because that's the enigma of planet Earth. It's got an atmosphere far thinner than it should have. But that far thinner atmosphere is what we need to live here.
But why
didn't
Venus take
water? It's too hot. Yeah. It's also less massive. I mean, whether or not a planet's going to hang on to water depends on its gravity and its temperature.
Just slightly, it has
Yeah, we're about 15% more massive than Venus, so it gives us a little stronger gravity, and we're cooler than Venus. And the lower the temperature, the higher the probability you will retain a molecule of a certain mass. And the stronger the gravity, the higher the probability you have of retaining a molecule of that mass. And as we pointed out, we went through Genesis chapter 1, Earth has the temperature and the mass to hang on to lots of water, but not lots of ammonia and methane. I mean, there you're talking about the Earth being so beautifully designed that it keeps the 18 molecular weight, but is not able to keep the 16 and the 17. In addition to that, the Earth's upper atmosphere sets up chemical reactions, which even more rapidly get rid of the 16 and the 17, but do no damage at all to the 18. And that only works on one planet. Only with planet Earth do you have those conditions set up so that you keep lots of water, but you don't wind up absorbing a lot of ammonia and methane. And that's what you need for light. Lots of water, but you don't want ammonia and methane. Yes?
So the Mars-sized object that for us, that's not just theory to explain the moon, so there's some kind of evidence that we're
working? Well, I got to talk about this when I was up at space camp with the other parents, and this is really fun. So, and in fact, a couple of the guys signed up on our mailing list. They already had some evidence of this before astronauts went to the moon. I mean, one of the things we noticed was that the moon is spiraling away from the Earth at 6 centimeters per year, indicating that the moon was much closer to the Earth than it was now, even almost touching. And but they couldn't explain how you get a moon forming out of the Earth. Because if we're this close to the sun and the two bodies kind of formed together, somehow split during their formation process, the moon should have been destroyed. So it survived. And that was kind of an unanswered question. Then someone said, well, maybe what happened is a body hit the Earth and split a piece off, and that piece became the moon. That doesn't work either, because of how close we are to the sun. If that had happened, then the lunar piece would not be able to maintain a stable orbit about the Earth. And so that just kind of made them doubt what they were seeing, the spiraling away effect. But if you trace the spiraling away effect, it indicates a date for the moon that's later than the date for the Earth. I mean, now we know the age of the Earth very accurately to be 4.59 billion years. But even before they went to the moon, they were getting different dates for the Earth. They got a date from the spiraling away effect. They also got a date by looking at the craters. And we know that the moon has a very tiny argon atmosphere. And that argon atmosphere with a 29 rotation period is sufficient to cause some erosion of the craters of the moon, the oldest craters. And that indicated that the oldest geologic features on the moon were 4.25 billion years old. Not 4.6, but 4.25. And so this is a mystery that was plaguing astronomers before the Apollo space program. Also, the early Apollo measurements were able to come up with the thickness of the lunar dust, and it was 60 millimeters. And you would get 60 millimeters in 4.25 billion years. Not 65. I mean, we were getting the wrong answer for 4.6 billion. We're coming with a younger date. But what really forced astronomers to consider that the Earth must have experienced an exotic collision was when they brought back the lunar rocks. And they used radiometric dating, and it came out of precisely 4.25 billion years. But the thing that really clinched it is they looked at the chemistry of those rocks and concluded that the lunar chemistry is radically different from the Earth's. Meaning that there's no possibility that the moon formed out of the same substance that the Earth formed out of. And so that forced astronomers to look into explanations of the moon as independent of the Earth. And the only one that works is for the Earth to experience a collision by an object 9 times the mass of the moon, literally the size of Mars, where most of that planet gets absorbed into the core of the Earth. And you would get a dust debris cloud forming about the Earth as a result of that absorption of the Mars-sized object. And that would coalesce and make the moon, which would also cause it to begin spiraling away. It increased the mass of the Earth. It also gave us a stainless steel liquid core. And that's a blessing because that allows Earth to maintain a relatively strong magnetic field, which sets up a Van Allen belt that protects life on the surface from solar X-rays. You know, here's NASA talking about going to Mars with the people. But how are they going to protect them against all those solar X-rays? I mean, one of the proposals is to have the astronauts live inside a lead box as they go to Mars and back. But if they're going to spend more than a day or two on the surface of Mars, they've got to land the lead box on the surface so that they can stay there while they do their explorations. Then you've got to take the lead box back to Earth. And you know how expensive it is to send up lead into outer space. As we discovered that the space camp, it's $1,000 a pound. That's why they don't like to send overweight astronauts into outer space. So each pound costs them $1,000. Well, I remember when I was training to be an astronomer, and one of my friends wanted to be an astronaut, and he was too heavy and too tall. The limit was 6 feet. If you're over 6 feet tall, you couldn't go into the program. Now you can get into the program. But they still are worried about that that pound. Every pound is $1,000. Well, sending up a little lead box to protect astronauts, I mean, lead's very heavy. And one of the problems they're facing is, you know, they got to make the lead box really small in order to prevent the cost from going into quadrillions of dollars. And can you imagine spending, say, 3 or 4 years inside a small lead box with 5 or 6 other people? So, well, there are people that have volunteered for these kinds of, we're getting off the subject, but there are people who volunteered for these kinds of experiments, and, you know, solitary confinement's kind of like that, right? But the difference is this. It's one thing spending time with 3 or 4 of your friends in a very tiny cubicle here on Earth, knowing that if you go crazy, you can get out. Okay, but if you're way over there on Mars, and suddenly you lose it psychologically.
There's no milk.
Thank you, Tom. Ted. Lead's not the only thing. A Van Allen belt does quite nicely, but you can't take that with you. Not cheaply. I mean, that's been proposed. Why don't we just set up an artificial Van Allen belt, but it's actually cheaper to put them in a lead box. So, lead's the best substance known to man that will protect against that kind of radiation. And, you know, there are other substances that will work. Well, I mean, to give you an idea, I don't quote me on this because I'm kind of guessing. I'm trying to remember back to my undergraduate days. But, like, that's a long time ago, right? Thank you, Kathy.
Happy Father's Day to you.
Let me tell you how many years younger Kathy is than me, all right? Let's not get into that, all right? No, I do remember this one little fact, though. 1 inch of lead is equivalent to 13 feet of concrete.
Wow.
So it's a little cheaper to put up 1 inch of lead than 13 feet of concrete. So,
Van Allen belt.
What's a Van Allen belt?
How does that keep the X-rays from
Well, okay, because the Earth has a magnetic field, and because of the way it's positioned relative to rotation axis, the Earth has these magnetic lines of field that kind of envelop the planet, you know, tens of thousands of miles out. And what that does is it traps all these particles, so they go whipping around the magnetic fields that are, you know, tens of thousands of miles beyond the Earth, rather than just pouring straight down to the surface and messing up your proteins. And so it's like a magnetic shield that protects life here on planet Earth.
So,
yeah, they interact with the particles that are whipping around the magnetic fields.
So the Van Allen belt is a result of the particles interacting with the magnetic field around the Earth. Can we describe that as the Van Allen belt?
Well, a Van Allen belt is basically the magnetic field structure with the charged particles running around it, but that acts as a very effective shield against us getting too many solar X-rays. And, yeah, you go to Mars, there's no such shield there. Yeah, you go to Mercury or Venus, no such shield there. It's not happening. You go to Jupiter, there's a nice shield like that, but there you got a problem where the magnetic field, the Van Allen belt itself becomes a problem. It's too powerful. And then you got other satellites like Io that are interfering with it. So you got to kind of dodge and here on Earth, it's just right. So, yes. Yes, I think you're going to hear NASA talk about that come July 4th, that Europa is a place where the surface looks like broken up ice floes. That's their terminology. I think more accurately, what we're seeing is a pattern of crustal disturbance. It's similar to what we see in the Arctic ice cap. Therefore, they've concluded that it's ice, and they say with the Arctic ice cap, you don't get those broken up features unless you got liquid water underneath the ice. So they're assuming that Europa, because it has these broken features that look a lot like the broken up ice flows on the Arctic ice cap, that proves that there's liquid water below the surface of Europa. If there's liquid water, there's got to be life. In fact, I saw on Ted Koppel's Nightline some NASA astronomers saying, this is so exciting, we've got to convince the taxpayers for us to send a mission to Europa. And this thing's going to be incredible. It's going to go to Europa, it's going to land on this surface of Europa, and then it's going to begin to drill through whatever that stuff is, get to the so-called liquid water underneath, and that's not all. Then it's going to drop this little rover down the borehole. And then once it gets down to the liquid stuff, it's going to swim around and photograph bacteria for us. And then it's going to swim back to the borehole, go all the way up, and send the pictures back to Earth. Okay? Well, I mean, Ted's asked the question, this sounds technologically just incredible, impossible. And the NASA scientist said, there are no technological barriers. The only barriers are financial.
Yes.
Now, I would agree with him. We can do it if we taxpayers will fork over enough cash. Now, I was waiting for Ted to ask the question, how much money is this thing going to cost? He never asked the question. Program ended at that point. But I can't think of any... well, he did make the point. This is unmanned, so it's nothing like the Apollo program or a manned trip to Mars. And says, yeah, he's probably right about that. But it's going to be a few billion bucks. Yeah, it's not like your typical mission that costs a few hundred million and that's it. Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, that kind of, I think I brought that out in the Facts and Faith. It's in your mailboxes now. is that because we discover life under extreme conditions here on Earth, people are saying Christians are overly skeptical. You know, we find life in these steam vents in the ocean, and that means that you don't need a narrow temperature range for life to exist. But as we pointed out in the Facts and Faith article, the flaw is this. It's not that life can only exist within a narrow temperature range around 50 degrees Fahrenheit. It's 50 degrees Fahrenheit multiplied by the pressure that exists at that location. And the reason why you can have life in 113 degrees centigrade, which works out to about 240 degrees Fahrenheit under these ocean vents, is because the pressure there is much higher than what it is on the surface of the Earth. And if you take into account the pressure, it's the exact narrow range for which life can survive. I mean, if you talk about 240 degrees Fahrenheit and the pressure we have here, life's impossible under any circumstances. But recognizing that the pressures under these deep ocean vents are hundreds of times greater than what we experience at the surface, that moves the range in which temperature can, or in which life can possibly exist, up. The boiling point of water isn't 212 degrees when you've got that kind of pressure. And so what really what should be stated and recognized by these NASA scientists is that the temperature necessary for the support of life is so many degrees beyond the freezing point of water and so many degrees below the boiling point of water. And if you're in the deep caves, I mean, because that's another thing they found. They found life 2 miles down at high temperatures in South African gold mines. But there again, the pressure's higher. And so, yeah, it's going to push the temperature up for ideal life support to a higher degree. Take that into account, it's still the narrow range. So, but again, you see this powerful motivation on the part of some NASA scientists, not all NASA scientists, trying to say, look, it's not a narrow, fine-tuned design situation for life. It's really very broad. Give us the money, we'll prove it to you. We'll send this thing to photograph bacteria underneath the crust of Europa. Incidentally, I do agree with NASA. There's something plastic underneath the surface of Europa that explains the features that are there. It may even be liquid water. We haven't proven that it's liquid water. And even if we find liquid water there, I can show you a lot of liquid water where there's no life. You know, all you got to do is take a cup of liquid water, boil it, let it sit there in under controlled conditions, and you've got to wait a long time before anything living is going to show up in it. And what's amazing is Pasteur did an experiment like that 100 years ago. Because the reigning paradigm in the days before Pasteur is any standing water will spawn life. That's because any standing water here on Earth is being impacted by life all the time. Bacteria are floating around. But what he demonstrated is if you cut off the flow of a foreign life coming to the system, it never produces life. And so that changed the whole way of thinking about life on our planet 100 years ago. But now we seem to be going back. You know, leave meat by itself and it will produce maggots, right? People used to believe that. Now we realize if you keep the meat in the refrigerator, the maggots never show up. So, yes. And then someone else here had a question, too. Yeah, go ahead.
Excuse me. One comment. LA Times had an article a couple weeks ago, column one, about the origin of life. And they made comment, unless we explain how it happened here, we're going to have a hope to explain how it happened out somewhere else.
That's a very good statement. That whatever we've discovered about the solar system, one thing we all know, atheists and Christians alike, is that the conditions are most ideal here on planet Earth. And that none of the planets have ever had conditions superior to what we see here on Earth. Therefore, if we can't explain the origin of life under natural conditions here on Earth, there's no hope of an explanation elsewhere. And that's the situation. In spite of 40 years of intense research on the origin of life, nothing has been produced that demonstrates any indication of a natural explanation for even the simplest steps that are necessary for the assembly of life systems. Yes. Okay. I think your point is this: that it, you know, this theory that explains the origin of the moon as a coalescing of stuff out of this dust debris cloud. Surely not all of that dust went into the formation of the moon. Some of it must have fallen on the Earth. A whole lot of it went into the sun. And do we find any evidence of this stuff? Well, it's 4.25 billion years ago, and because of the plate tectonic and volcanism activity of planet Earth has been so thoroughly mixed in to the rest of the Earth that you really can't separate it as something distinct from the geology of the Earth. The problem there being that Earth is 80 times more massive than the Moon. And so that kind of mixing is really going to make it impossible to make a distinction. With the Moon, it's 100%. With the Earth, it's far less than, I'll be below 0.1% would be left still on the surface of the Earth.
And the dating of the Moon is
2.5 billion, right?
Why did the clock start with the Moon after the Earth
Okay, it's not just one radiometric tool. There's several radiometric tools they use to get that. You got the potassium argon, you got uranium, you got thorium. Yeah, in some cases, what you wind up with is a date. That would be consistent when the stuff actually formed out of a supernova, which would be true of everything within the solar system. In other cases, it takes you back to the time when it was a molten mass, so that really does give you an origin date for the system. And you know, like when you look at meteors, you get a slightly different date than you look at the Earth's crust, because the Earth's crust formed later. And so, yeah, there are some clocks that do get reset when it goes into that state. Others don't. So you got to compare the two. They get reset, right?
None of the other clocks got reset because you had projectors going out.
Some get reset, some don't, which is really a real help to the physicists because you know, they can compare the two, and that adds additional support to the conclusion.
But what I asked, are there no clocks that did not get reset? In other words, can you find stuff from the moon that is the age of the Earth?
There's stuff on the Earth as well as the moon that gives you dates that are consistent with the meteors, and the meteors are considered to be a good measure of when stuff began to come together and make planets in the solar system. There's a small amount of that evidence, but most of the radiometric evidence points you to the formation of the body itself. But yeah, if you got enough of both, it really lends support to the whole scenario. But I'll be honest with you, the former is not as strong as what the astronomers would like it to be. But in that sense, they really don't need it because they have things like the thickness of the lunar dust, the erosion of the lunar craters, compared to erosion that we see in other solar system bodies that helps. You know, you always feel better when you got three or four different methods all giving you the same answer. In the case of the moon, we have that. And you look at Mercury, you get different dates. Yes.
So, assuming that this is what really happens, something about the sea, then rejecting most of the first material rather than material.
Yeah, what's really happening is that because the Earth is so much more massive, It tends to be less disturbed than the stuff from the Mars-sized body. Most of the Mars-sized body gets absorbed into the core of the Earth, and there's a residual that forms as dust cloud. Some Earth stuff gets up there, and maybe I need to correct what I'm saying in the sense that you're not dating the Mars-sized object. What you're dating is the event where the Mars-sized object got absorbed, the dust cloud appeared, and then the moon forms out of that. Otherwise, you'd be getting the date of the Mars-sized object. Instead, what you're getting is the date of when the Mars-sized object ceased to exist and the moon began to exist. A lot of chemistry. And so the Mars-sized, the stuff from the Mars-sized object, which has mixed in with it a little bit of Earth stuff, it will be chemically disturbed in a way that's distinct from what remains here on the Earth or what existed in the Mars-sized object. I mean, if there was no chemical disturbance, we would expect it to be practically the same as the Earth. Because after all, the Mars-sized object would very probably be the same date as the age of the Earth. All of solar system bodies forming at about the same time. So some event happened that caused a chemical disturbance. But with the collision, you get lots of heat to explain that chemical disturbance. Yes?
In entering the atmosphere of the Earth, that Mars-sized object, you see that too, just like you see the news, right?
That's true.
It's going to be this fiery thing.
Actually, you know what? We're putting this all into our Journey Towards Creation video. And I just talked with the animator on Wednesday or Thursday morning. And I didn't think he could do this, but we're not giving him much money. But he says, I got a new software thing that makes it possible for us to do this. So this is wonderful. We're going to be able to portray all this thing. So what you're going to be able to do is see this Mars-sized object coming towards the Earth in slow motion. Then as it gets close to the Earth's atmosphere, you see this heat shock form. And so you're going to be able to see this red glow forming just as it reaches the Earth's atmosphere. And it causes that point on the Earth where it's making contact to heat up, as well as that point on the Mars-sized object. But because the Mars-sized object is only one-ninth the mass of the Earth, it begins to heat up all over. It begins to be impacted to a far greater degree. But you're going to be able to see all this glowing stuff pouring out. And it really does match quite carefully the computer calculation by astronomers on how the collision must have worked. You're going to see the thing being pulled into the Earth, but the heat remains. And you get this ring of heat all around the Earth, and the dust begins to fill up this ring of heat, and then the thing begins to cool, the particles begin to coalesce, make the moon, and you begin to watch the moon slowly spiral away from the Earth. Now, this guy says he can animate all this thing for us, so I'm looking forward to what he produces, because I didn't think he could do this for the kind of bucks we're offering. Pardon me?
Have him
design a screensaver. We can pay for the thing. Good idea. Yeah, Ted.
Is it really credible to believe that the Mars-sized object is going to hit the Earth, leave the Earth in its orbit? Wouldn't something that massive hitting the Earth, even a glancing blow, cause a disturbance in the orbit of the Earth?
Okay, good question. Wouldn't this have disturbed the Earth's orbit? Well, it's one-ninth the mass of the Earth, so it doesn't disturb it that much, but you're right, it does disturb it some. Okay? Now, it probably disturbed it enough that it put us in the exact orbit that's necessary for life. We don't know what the primordial orbit of the Earth was, except that it had to be very close to what it is today. But as you see in the crater in the cosmos, if you disturb it by 0.5%, that puts it outside the life support zone. So it's possible it disturbed it by 2%, but that 2% disturbance wound up putting the Earth in exactly that life support zone.
Is it possible to
No, we can't do that. Well, we know what the impact would do. In other words, we can calculate how much of a disturbance of the Earth's orbit the impact would have generated. But if you're asking the question, can we discern what the orbit of the Earth was like before the collision took place? No, we can't do. We can tell you, well, it was either here or here or here or here or here. But we know it was different by a certain percentage, possibly. I mean, there are collision scenarios where the disturbance is hardly any at all. You know, it really depends how the whole thing is absorbed. I mean, if you get a direct hit, for example, all goes straight into the core, you don't get much disturbance at all. But if it's slightly off-center, then you can get a significant disturbance. Well, there are various ways you can get to where it is today with it hitting head-on or hitting slightly off head-on. If it gets too much off head-on, then you don't get the end results that we see. A carom shot's not what you want. Well, if that happened, you wouldn't get a moon. Right, and the atmosphere wouldn't have been disturbed in the same way. By the way, I mean, you're right in making the comment. This really seems incredible. You know, this whole scenario was worked out before astronauts went to the moon and recovered those lunar rocks. It's just, I was a student at the time. And I remember my peers in astronomy and physics just saying, well, this is what our calculations show, but it can't possibly be right. It's just too incredible. The probability of this happening by chance is just so amazingly tiny that it couldn't have happened that way. There must be something we're not understanding. That was kind of what was taught in my classrooms, in my astronomy classrooms. What we now realize is the incredible really did happen. And you know, how do you explain that? Well, if you got a supernatural, intelligent creator behind the whole system, then we can understand how this is all going on. Yes?
I believe you're unfolding a theory.
So I don't have to convince you, all right?
I have one question. When I go back home to my library, I read it
Okay, you will not find that in Genesis chapter 1, as you well know. What you will find is, by the way, all of this is in this book I'm working on the first 11 chapters of Genesis. Now, where I stick this part in is the second creation day. Not that the lunar collision happens there, but the aftermath is described in the text at that point. There it speaks about God acting so the earth inherits an atmosphere that permits a stable water cycle. Now, from an astrophysical point of view, if nothing exotic happens in the solar system, no planet could possibly have an atmosphere with a stable water cycle. Because you need a planet that's as big as the Earth. But if the planet is as big as the Earth, it's going to have this very dense atmosphere, and you're not going to get a water cycle. You're going to wind up with a situation like Venus. Loads of carbon dioxide, very hot surface temperature, and you can forget about a water cycle. How did the Earth get a water cycle? Well, the point I'm making in the book is that this incredibly exotic, beautifully fine-tuned collision is what enabled the statements that we see on the second creation day to be fulfilled. And there is no other explanation. But when we see just how fine-tuned that collision must be, we realize this has got to be the result of an intelligent creator. Because sometimes you read the first two creation days and it says, let there be light, and let there be water above and below the water, and you say, what's the big deal? What God must have done is just wander around and pick a planet that's just right. But see, our understanding today drives us to the conclusion that, hey, if the universe contains 100 billion trillion planets, and all you got is God running around and picking the best one out of the 100 billion trillion, he isn't going to find it. There aren't enough planets, with them all having different characteristics. This, the level of fine-tuning is so great that we realize that God not only intervened to create the universe, he must have intervened after the sun had formed to guarantee that we have a sun, a moon, a Mars-sized object, a Jupiter, a Saturn, and all the rest of it, so life would be possible here on planet Earth. And so, because sometimes people look at the last three creation days and say that's where God was performing his miracles. My point is, we have just as much evidence for God performing intervention miracles in the first three creation days, partly because of what we now know about this collision. Yeah, Greg.
One of the things that really helps people accept the idea that you report about 65 characters is that even scientists, non-believing scientists, is there consensus on these 65 points of fine-tuning, or is it
Yeah, Reasons to Believe is the only organization that I'm aware of that's actually assembled the whole list. However, you will find material published by secular scientists. As far as I know, I don't know of any of them. Well, I know one of them that's a believer, but all the rest of the 65 characteristics were published by people who were not pushing a Christian agenda at all, quite the opposite. And you will find in the secular literature material that supports all 65. But there's only, the only other book I know of that's made any attempt to assemble them is a professor of physics at down there in Louisiana. I'm trying to think of his name. It's not Frank Tipler. Kathy, you might be aware. Trying to drag out the name. Not Davies, huh? No. Anyway, he assembled eight characteristics. And so you will find in the literature people who attempt to assemble, but once they get to 5, 6, or 8, they don't go any further. We're the only ones that have tried to have any completeness to it. Now, what's interesting is that this fellow I'm trying to think of the name of, who came up with 8, he says, it's enough. Just based on these 8, we realize that Earth is not an accident. There must be a designer behind the universe to explain even just these 8. And he did make the point in his paper, I could go on, but 8's enough. I've just found that sometimes when you produce a few more than 8, it convinces those that have a hard time saying, well, you know, it's one chance in a quadrillion, but yeah, I know we're out of time. But I'm going to let this gentleman say something because he hasn't had a chance yet. Go ahead. Have we put this on the website yet?
No.
Oh, the website notebook, has it gotten all the way around? Is it stuck somewhere? Yeah, it got stuck right there.
Never got passed.
It'll have no. It'll happen next week.
Next week.
We'll have to do it next week. All right. Right. That's it.
Operating system crashed. Okay.
But if any of you are super eager and can't wait till next week, you can see this gentleman after class. Yeah, he'll get you signed up. Our apologies. I thought the thing was going around. So, Tom will give you a lecture about this next week. We can count on it, okay? And next week, I actually will get to this folder. You know, I kind of brought this in and said this will take 1 minute, and then we'll really get into this. Okay, I'm not going to bring up any little special comments next week. We'll get straight into this, all right? Just pray nothing gets discovered between now and next week. No, please don't do that. All right. Father in heaven, we thank you for this amazing day in which we live today, that, Lord, things are happening literally every week, sometimes every day, that makes the evidence for your creative activity stronger and stronger. And, Lord, I just thank you for this amazing timing that here I was scheduled to go up and do some television production, and you placed within our hands something so new that not even the NASA team will be aware of it come the July 4th announcement. And thank you for giving that to us. And we do pray that you would open up doors for this response to be made available beyond the Christian community. And we pray you would do that for us. And I pray you would take care of the details of getting this thing produced and that it would be a very high quality, insufficient time to be used. Father, thank you for those people up there in Seattle and just the skills they bring to bear and the new kinds of software that enable us to beautifully portray this to a public at a reasonable cost. And we just ask again that you would guide that project through to completion and be able to reach people who otherwise would not be motivated to read books or even comic books. Thank you for this class and its enthusiasm and the motivation. And I just bless you, Lord, that what would normally take a couple of minutes because of the interest and the curiosity and the hunger that this class has, that we get into it too in a way that in some respects enables us to communicate this together to people that we meet all over the place. And I pray that there would be individuals in this class that have an opportunity to share some of this new exciting evidence with their friends and associates, and that would open doors for them to respond to your truth, life, and love. May it change us too. In Jesus' name, amen.